the limelight.
A year has passed since immigrant rights advocates filed a federal complaint about human rights violations, including invasive gynecological procedures without full consent being performed on women at an immigration prison in Georgia. But the survivors of these abuses are still waiting for justice and restitution. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Priyanka Bhatt, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Survivors of Medical Abuse at ICE Jail in Georgia are still waiting for justice. Stay tuned for more. A year has passed since immigrant rights advocates filed a federal complaint about human rights violations, including invasive gynecological procedures without full consent being performed on women at an immigration prison in Georgia, but the survivors of these abuses are still waiting for justice and restitution. The federal complaint made international headlines for advocates filed it with the Department of Homeland Security Office of Inspector General, detailing horrific accounts from detained immigrants and whistleblower nurse Don Wooten. Even so, there have been grossly inadequate actions taken to hold Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, accountable for these abuses. While the Department of Homeland Security ordered the ICE contract at Irving County Detention Center to be terminated in May 2021, the prison still remains open. Worse yet, the immigrants who were previously detained at Irving were transferred to other deadly ICE prisons in Georgia, despite calls from advocates to release them. While House Resolution 1153 passed in October 2020, condemning the invasive non-consensual procedures and calling for full cooperation into investigations of Irving County Detention Center, there have been no congressional hearings and no updates on the status of the original Office of Inspector General complaint filed. The survivors of Irving County Detention Center deserve justice in the form of closure of Irving County Detention Center along with all ICE prisons, immediate accountability for the violations that occurred in ICE custody, immigration relief, and reparations. Georgia is home to three ICE prisons where 8 immigrants have died in the past 4 years. There have been documented abuses affecting thousands of detained immigrants, ranging from medical neglect to forced labor. These horrible conditions can be attributed, at least in part, to a subculture of bigotry within the state that has created legal detention pipelines like anti-immigrant state laws and 287 programs that funnel immigrants into ICE prisons for minor infractions and deny them equity and opportunity. Wendy Dow is one of the survivors of that system and of an invasive non-consensual gynecological procedure while incarcerated at the Irving County Detention Center. A black immigrant from Jamaica, Dow lived in Georgia for more than a decade, always in fear of the overly aggressive targeting of immigrants by law enforcement. A report on law enforcement in Gwinnett County, where Dow lived, documented a pattern of racial profiling where immigrants often reported being stopped without probable cause or reasonable suspicion. In addition to being subjected to warrantless searches, Dow was attacked by police dogs. While police looked on, I kept telling the police to get the dogs off me, but they waited until my legs and fingers were beaten up for no particular reason, Dow recalls. That incident led to her arrest and transfer to ICE custody. but nothing prepared her for the grim realities of the Irving County Detention Center. The stress of being confined in treacherous conditions and separated from her children led to spikes in blood pressure and vision problems. One day, while showering, Dow fell, hit her head, and fainted. Despite being in terrible pain, she was not transferred to an outside hospital because she was told she didn't have any broken bones. This lack of care is common at the Irving County Detention Center. But the worst was yet to come. During a gynecology appointment, Dow had been told that she had cysts in her stomach that needed to be treated. Very early one morning, weeks later, she was abruptly woken up and told to get dressed to go to see a doctor. Dow assumed the visit concerned her high blood pressure, but instead, she was taken to a hospital and told she was having surgery to remove cysts from her stomach. She was given no other explanation. When Dow woke up from surgery, she was back at the Irving County Detention Center. There were bandages on my stomach and pain on my side and under my navel, Dow recalls. At Irving, no one would tell her what procedure she had been subjected to, and no one provided any medication for the terrible pain, even as the wound became infected, leaking yellow pus. To them, I was another person without documents. I was nobody, she says, adding, I was scared of not coming out. I wrote a will to my brother telling him what to do with my children because I felt like I wasn't going to come out alive. Dow is one of at least 40 Irving County Detention Center survivors who underwent invasive procedures without their full knowledge and consent. In a recently published report, another survivor shared that after finding out her fallopian tube had been removed without her consent, she was extremely distressed and suffered periods of depression and anger, knowing that she could not naturally conceive children anymore. Yet another survivor noted that her appointment that she felt pain like childbirth and felt like her was rotting from inside. The threat of a state-sanctioned violence against women's bodies, and in particular black and brown communities, is unfortunately not new to the Peach State. Georgia was the 32nd state to pass a sterilization law in 1937 and sterilized more than 3,000 individuals, the fifth highest in the country. Eugenics politics across U.S. legalized pseudoscientific practices used primarily by white elites to control black or indigenous people, immigrants, poor women, and people with disabilities who they believed were unfit or feeble-minded. These white supremacist policies continue today in many different forms, including in ICE practices and xenophobic anti-black legislation. Just like the Georgia State Board of Eugenics in 1930s, the majority white male legislators of the current Georgia General Assembly often continue to make decisions that harm communities of color and women, from its passage of Jim Crow voter suppression bill to a draconian anti-abortion bill and scores of anti-immigrant bills. The road to accountability and reparations for these abuses promises to be long and grueling. I'm speaking out to bring awareness to us women, mothers, daughters who got abused at the hands of ICE so that it doesn't happen to anyone else, Dow says, adding, I would like to hold the U.S. government, ICE, and the Irving staff and doctors accountable for what happened to us and to all others, physically, mentally, and emotionally. I'm calling for justice.
What's the worst nightmare for an intelligence agency? The moment its spies start to disappear. The agents and sources, so carefully recruited and nurtured, often over many years, simply vanish, one after the other. This is apparently the case with the CIA, as a cable from the agency's counterintelligence said America's Central Intelligence Agency has lost too many of the people it recruited from other countries to spy for the United States in recent years. This news raises some very important questions, like, has the CIA lost its touch? Is the agency doing enough to protect the informants it recruits in foreign countries? And are the CIA's rivals getting ahead of American spies?
Mr. Amir Rahimpour, who was arrested for spying for the CIA, had established links with a spy service, received large salaries, and tried to provide information about the nuclear power of the Islamic Republic of Iran for the American service. He was uncovered, tried, and sentenced to death. And the country's Supreme Court recently confirmed the verdict of this American spy.
Cable's report matches the news coming out every now and then about CIA sources who were arrested or executed. In fact, it's not a new issue. The agency has lost so many spies in Iran. For example, in 2019, Iranian officials said they had arrested 17 people who were working for the CIA in Iran. In another example, the agency had to curb its spying in Lebanon in 2011 after the arrest of several informants in Beirut. China also once in one operation captured some 20 CIA spies. The story was widely publicized in 2018. And there's another issue. It's not just about hunting down agents and capturing them. Many adversarial intelligence services in countries such as Russia, China, Iran, and Pakistan have been turning the CIA sources into double agents.
Just a moment ago, on the ninth floor of the federal courthouse next door, a former CIA case officer, one of those individuals entrusted with protecting our nation and its secrets, was just sentenced to 19 years in prison. Jerry Chun Sing Lee joins Ames, Regan, Pitts, and Mallory on the wall of infamous traitors prosecuted here in the Eastern District of Virginia. For arguably $840,000, Lee sold out the United States. He abused the trust that his superiors, the U.S. government, and frankly, the people of the United States placed in him.
Sometimes it's not even an intelligence agency, but a terrorist group with limited resources that do this. The 2009 bombing at a CIA base in Afghanistan's Khost is a good example. A Jordanian doctor the CIA thought it had convinced against al-Qaeda had in fact turned against the United States. The man blew himself up and seven CIA agents were killed. The same CIA that was responsible for numerous coups and chaotic political shifts in the world now seems that the agency's skills in training informants or thwarting rivals have become old and rusty. At the same time, CIA rivals have become more powerful and focused. It's not that the agency is not focused on training its spies, but many former officials believe the focus of the CIA is now on what it calls terrorist threats at countries that the US has invaded in the past two decades, like Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria. They also say that the agency tends to underestimate foreign intelligence agencies and moves too quickly to recruit spies without considering counterintelligence risks.
I guess what I would say at the start is that, you know, I think we have to be clear-eyed about the reality, looking at the potential terrorism challenge, that both al-Qaeda and ISIS in Afghanistan remain intent on recovering the ability to attack U.S. targets, whether it's in the region, in the West, or ultimately in the homeland. After years of sustained counterterrorism pressure, the reality is that neither of them have that capacity today. and that there are terrorist groups, whether it's Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula or in other parts of the world, who represent much more serious threats today.
Another problem of the CIA is the technology revolution. There was a time when the United States was among a few countries that possessed high-tech gadgets and systems that aided its agents on their spy missions. Now, every country is developing its own spyware, gadgets, and data-gathering tools. The CIA's traditional human intelligence model can't survive the digital age. And it's not just about the CIA. No intelligence agency can survive on its old methods.
If confirmed, four crucial and interrelated priorities will shape my approach to leading CIA: China, technology, people, and partnerships. As President Biden has underscored, outcompeting China will be key to our national security in the decades ahead. That will require a long-term, clear-eyed, bipartisan strategy.
Nearly everyone agrees that social media, cell phones, facial recognition technology, and supercomputers that crunch big data have dramatically complicated the business of espionage. The technology revolution has made it all but impossible to maintain false identities and disguise relationships. In other words, the CIA's decades-old spying model has been overtaken by technology. There are many intelligence officials that strongly believe that with careful planning and professional operation, covert intelligence gathering by agents and others can still work. But history has shown time and again that even the most carefully planned operations can be uncovered with the help of technology. In 2010, a high-ranking member of the Hamas resistance movement, Mahmoud al-Mabhouh, was found dead in his hotel room in Dubai. It took Dubai police less than a month to find those behind the killing and expose them. It was a plot by Israeli intelligence to assassinate Mabhouh. Dubai police uncovered the plot by assembling CCTV videos of the Mossad agents. The Israeli team used a method called solid tradecraft, and technology exposed them. The most recent example is the assassination of Jamal Khashoggi, the Saudi journalist who was brutally killed and dismembered in Istanbul. The story of his assassination by rough agents hired by the Saudi crown prince filled the internet in less than a week after his disappearance. CCTV footage, facial recognition tools, and phone records revealed everything. So the technology revolution is not only the problem of the CIA, but every other intelligence agency in the world. But how is it that it cost the CIA so many spies? Is the US intelligence agency incapable of protecting its agents? If so, is there a guarantee that it can recruit spies in the future? Nobody wants to gamble their lives by becoming an informant at risk of exposure. So the agency might experience difficulties in convincing people to commit treason and work for them in their own countries. Of course, the CIA has never relied on any spies for collecting information. It has many ways to gather data for its analysts, to craft into briefings for policymakers. But the networks of humanists around the world are very much the centerpiece of CIA's efforts. The kind of intelligence that the agency is supposed to be the best in the world at collecting and analyzing. Former officials of the agency say recruiting new informants is how the CIA officers earn promotions. And judging by the recent Cable report, it's safe to say the CIA officers are not doing the very best they can. Or maybe they do, they're just not good enough. Or maybe the rivals are just better than them.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsetodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsetodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
The United States has urged Britain to follow its example and try to repair its relations with Paris in the wake of the row over France's loss of its submarine contract with Australia. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's diplomatic editor, Patrick Winter. The piece is titled U.S. urges U.K. to rebuild relations with Paris after submarine contract row. The United States has urged Britain to follow its example and try to repair its relations with Paris in the wake of the row over France's loss of its submarine contract with Australia. Australia pulled out of the $66 billion contract for 12 diesel-electric-powered submarines signed in 2016 to opt instead for nuclear-powered submarines to be developed with America and the United Kingdom. The secretive and sudden cancellation of the contract has created a crisis of trust between Paris on the one hand and London, Canberra and Washington on the other. But senior U.S. diplomats, including the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, spent 2 days in France and Brussels trying to repair relations after French leaders made clear they felt the trio of nations had gone behind their back to form the new alliance. Antony Blinken met the French Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian in Paris on 5th of October. The U.S.'s National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan also met the French Foreign Policy Advisor Emmanuel Bon. French President Emmanuel Macron is also due to hold a bilateral face-to-face meeting with President Joe Biden at the G20 summit in Rome, Italy. U.S. diplomats have been disappointed that the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has not made any parallel effort to patch up relations with President Macron. There has been one explanatory phone call, while Boris Johnson expressed his frustration with French complaints over the loss of the contract, saying, "Donnez-moi un break." One diplomat said, "We had hoped for a three-legged stool of Britain, Europe and the United States, but we're having to run more of a hub-and-spoke operation in which we reach out separately to democracies in Europe, UK and Asia." The diplomat expressed hope that the British would think more strategically about relations with Europe. One senior US diplomat admitted in retrospect the handling of the Australian cancellation of the French contract was an unforced error, and at best, there should have been a decent 3-month interval before the announcement of the new security alliance between Australia, Britain, and the United States. There were disagreements within the Biden administration about how to handle the affair once it was clear that Australia wanted to end the submarine contract and adopt U.S. nuclear-propelled submarines. Some argued that it was foolish to alienate the French, since the interregnum created by the German elections meant that France was effectively at the helm of the European foreign policy. The Australians insisted on secrecy. The French have now largely decided to capitalize on US political embarrassment to win concessions from Washington over a strengthened European defense pillar inside NATO, greater US cooperation in fighting terrorism in the Sahel, and recognition of the legitimacy of the European Union's role in the Indo-Pacific region, which will be highlighted by a special conference convened by the French during its presidency of the European Union in the first half of next year. But there is no parallel rapprochement between the French and the Australians, or the British. The French Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian, giving evidence to the French Parliament, said the ball remained in Boris Johnson's court, adding that there had been a promise of proposals from the French, but none had been submitted. He was even more scathing about Canberra, saying that it had taken a leap into the unknown by choosing to resort to technology that Australians do not and will not master in the future. They thus placed themselves entirely at the mercy of developments in American policy. I wish our Australian partner, who made the choice for reasons of security, justified by the escalation of tensions with China, to the detriment of sovereignty, does not discover later that it has sacrificed both. The French Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian also said it was a matter of concern that the British, who are organising the Glasgow COP26 conference, had agreed to a trade deal with Australia without taking into account the Paris Climate Accord. France's Defence Minister Florence Parly has faced tough questioning about how the French intelligence services and defence industry could have misread the signals coming from Australia over the contract's future, or had been given no warning by the Americans. The French Defence Minister, Florence Parly, said no one could have envisaged Australia would be so willing to lose its sovereignty. The aggrieved tone still emerging from France contrasts with remarks by the European Union's External Affairs Chief, Josep Borrell, who on Friday, 15th of October, in Washington, D.C., put the submarine issue in the past by insisting that the controversy was now over.
Simple question.
Why is Britain increasingly out of stock? The United Kingdom has been hit by shortages in shops, at petrol stations, and in online deliveries. But what's causing this? Some blame staff shortfalls caused by the COVID-19 pandemic. But could it be that there's a deeper problem in the country, and one that cannot be easily resolved with a mass-scale vaccination program? After the United Kingdom's departure from the European Union, some claim that it has been an exodus of important workers from Britain that has contributed to this crisis. Amongst this exodus, it has been said foreign lorry drivers have returned to their homelands, while the local working population has been either unwilling or unable to fill this employment void.
shortages became visible and worrying to consumers, as the public resorted to panic buying to fill their cupboards, thereby also emptying the shelves. The result is as curious as it is frightening for the public. The impact of these shortages has been to create a real sense that there is some kind of sanctions regime within Britain as the supply chain struggles to get products to shelves and the products that are there are quickly bought up by a worried public. Online deliveries have also been heavily affected by the breakdown of the stock delivery system. As ministers consider making it easier to enter the UK if you have valid work credentials for haulage, some point to this as going against the very reasons they voted for Brexit.
What's causing these supply shortages? Brexit or something else? And how can a country as advanced as the United Kingdom end up with empty shelves and a shortage of basic goods? Simple questions with important answers. And let's start with this. How does the public here in a typical part of London feel about the shortage of products on the shelves and online? Here's what they told us.
Quite sad, quite fearful.
Food shortages. I feel like, you know, we all need food, right? So, like, food shortages is going to be bad. I mean, I have food right now in the crib. I don't experience any food shortages. But
I think it's affecting people's lives. I think, you know, for instance, if you go to the, you know, the local shops or the corner shops, you know, they're charging extra money, apparently each item, extra 50, 60 pence. Or £1 difference. So I think it was quite costing to the public.
Not good.
Not good.
Especially if you've got kids.
I do understand some shelves are empty or getting empty. And I've been listening to what the government is doing as well. And I hope that will be sorted out.
A bit worrying. Not saying that I'm panicking, but I'm just wondering if we're going to cope for the next couple of months if the shortages start carry on like that. But I mean, I'm cool. I'm still cool until something else happens. But yeah, there's a little worried all the time. But yeah,
I haven't seen any much. I'm still doing my shop normally. I still find the stuff I always buy. Haven't had any problems.
I can't do much about it because you go to Tesco sometime, I heard they haven't had a lot of chicken, Iceland. What can they do about it?
Well, I live in London and there's no shortage here. So I am up country naturally, less resources, less population. You'd expect delivery levels would be less as well. So I really don't see a problem with that, to be honest with you. It doesn't affect us down here as such. So, but up north, it's understandable. I don't think there's a real shortage as such. I think it's a... It's a mixture of panic buying and stressing the system a bit. So I think people are being too enthusiastic about buying things that they don't really need. And just to say I have it for two weeks of supply. But on the face of it, there's not a real shortage, but we would like to justify it and use Brexit and all the political rhetoric to say that there's a shortage to put a little pressure on the government, which is fun. I like seeing them squeal a bit, but there is I still can buy bread, I still can buy milk, and I still can get meat. So I am covering the core nutrients, the core proteins. So I don't see a shortage around, to be honest with you.
To be honest, I can't do much about it. A lot of my family is a bit worried, not that worried, but we know that everything's gonna come back, hopefully, fingers crossed. Food will be delivered and yeah, everyone will be fine. I don't know why everyone's panicking, but yeah.
Well, I don't like the fact that there's food shortages, and like it's really depressing to see that some people won't, like food is not going around as well as we would like it to, so yeah.
I think it's quite shocking that there's a shortage, because I wouldn't have expected it in London, but I think we're kind of getting through it. It's just quite a difficult time for quite a lot of people.
So what is causing these supply problems? Brexit? COVID? Or something else? The public had a wide range of answers.
It could be a culmination of both. I mean, they both kind of happen simultaneously. Yeah. So it's hard to say if it's this one or that one, because they're the most common denominators right now that we could look at in terms of why we're why the shelves are unstocked?
I don't have a shortage. This is complicated now.
Yeah.
With this coronavirus.
I would say combination, both Brexit and COVID-19 as well.
Brexit definitely as well, because they're shutting down the borders. Obviously, with the only borders we have open right now is the Irish borders, where we can import. So it's harder to export and import indefinitely.
To be honest, I would not blame Brexit and all of it, but I think it's just a lack of years and years of not preparing people, not putting professionals on the ground. There's a lot of youth that they're not finished studying. I think there's a combine of a lot of stuff. It's just a lack of worrying about social and integrate more people doing more labor instead of, you know, there's a lot of lawyers, ITs, but I think there's a lot of, you know, handcrafts and semi-skilled workers. There's not much.
I think it's a combination of all. Yeah, even though with COVID, a lot of people did panic buy, and which was not necessary. But I think with the Brexit as well, with everything, it's the uncertainty. I think that's what it causes panic, and then that's what happens, unfortunately.
Yeah, panicking a lot. Panicking is a big part of it, because especially when the COVID first happened, you saw all the panic buying tissues, hand sanitizers getting run out. So I think, this country needs to learn how to control when a lot of the population is panicking.
Oh, well, it's just timing. It's just a cacophony of a mixture of different things and different factors coming all at once and hitting us at once. Brexit, COVID, the evergreen, I don't remember, has been stuck in the canal. All of that is culminating in the world supply chain being thus in stasis, which has caused it fundamentally to seize up. It is because we're living in a globalized economy, and whenever someone sneezes in China, unfortunately, we will catch the flu. And that's just it. There's nothing wrong with that. It's just the fragility of the supply chain. The just-in-time theory isn't working as such. And I think fundamentally we need to go back to basics, where we grow our own food and build our own cars, go back to the Leland days, go back to the Bedford days when we were an independent country. Now we're so dependent on everybody else, it makes us look weak in the world and vulnerable to shortages, like we're saying, up north, but not down here.
A lot. I think it's the lack of delivery drivers, a lot, because there's a shortage of petrol as well. The shortage of food, I think it's because of COVID. Brexit is another cause as well, because we left Brexit. So, I think that's affected a lot of us as well,
I would think maybe right now, because of like the petrol crisis that have been going down, maybe it's the lorries or food deliveries that haven't been like coming in because of everyone's been panicking about like petrol shortage maybe.
I think the shortage of lorry drivers isn't helping a lot, like with the petrol. There's a lot of queues and a lot of people worrying, trying to stock up on things so they don't go like without food for the winter.
So how can it be that an advanced country like the United Kingdom can start suffering shortages of basic goods? Here's what the people here in London told us.
To be honest, if I was to think of Britain, something like this, I wouldn't think it would happen here, because I'd think that everything was in order and like they would plan ahead so something like this wouldn't happen, but I guess things happen.
Yeah, it's quite shocking that it's happening in London. You wouldn't expect it in like a big country connected to loads of other countries that we have shortages.
I wish I knew. It's panic, I think. Yeah, it's the uncertainty. I think that's what it is. And also, I think the fact that this this freedom of speech, and anyone can say whatever they want, and then it causes panic.
That's a good question, to be honest. That's something that I wonder myself all the time. What I've realised is, I don't know, but since this Brexit thing has happened, even though they promised us a whole different story, all this has been happening, panic buying, the country not controlling all these issues and stuff like that.
Well, I mean, wherever you go in this world, sometimes things over, sometimes things get down, isn't it? Sometimes things is very short, sometimes things is all right. So, I mean, you have to just try to do better for one another, to help one another, to let the things flow. But sometimes things are here and the people are just trying to...
Well, I should ask that the government. I think government should put in place maybe something different in schools. Maybe going towards any technicians and choose different routes in education. I think the education goes so... just going to the same place, is media, is performing arts, there's a lot of things. I don't see people not taking all carpenters, you know, engineers, is all based in everything electrical, nothing on a, you know, construction and things like this. So I think there's a lack of, even in agriculture, I think there's a lack of a lot of courses that could be introduced in education and then just pushing the communities to go in a different place instead of just being concentrated in the same type of things. I think it's just a combine of things. I don't think you just Brexit all the way down, but I just see a lot of things, you know. We are multicultural in this country, so it's complicated.
As I said, I don't really have a strong opinion myself, but the people around me, they think there's just the workers that were there, they simply left to Europe, and that's why there's a shortage now. Yeah, that's...
I think choices of the politicians, I think they make choices that we pay.
I thought today's world, being in the UK, I would have assumed things would have been put in place properly to make sure such thing should not happen. So I'm really, yes.
That's very sad, you know, because it's very sad if everything stops, you know. But they should bring the army to bring all the goods into this country. What the army is doing? Nothing. They're sitting there and do nothing.
Let's consider the facts. Office for National Statistics data shows that the number of large goods vehicle drivers has fallen from 330,000 in 2016 to 236,000 drivers by 2021. Also, the average age of HGV drivers is 55 and rising, indicating fewer people are applying to become haulage drivers than are leaving the profession. By September 2021, it was estimated there were 54,000 unprocessed HGV licenses in the system, made worse by staff strike action, social distancing measures and home working. The Road Haulage Association now estimates that the UK is short of over 100,000 drivers.
What should the government be doing to solve this problem of shortages and empty shelves? Here's the public's advice to ministers.
Yes, the government should have put some on reserve, should have made sure, because Brexit was happening, this has been going on for a while, so the government should have put an implementation in things before they happen.
I'd say if they want to, you know, put more control into it, they could, like, add in more strict laws, more rules. Like, when the lockdown was happening, they added all these, like, new rules so quickly in order to keep it under control. So I think if they learn how to do stuff like that more, it could help the country a lot.
Well, the government have to send out, I mean, like, people out there to, I mean, spectacle it, like, go in the shop and take all your items and see what is going on, what you send on top, what is selling for the government price. That's because, I mean, there are a lot of fake things in this country. Yeah, fake cigarette, fake this, fake that, the people are sending for a lot of money. And that's what messes up the society. You understand what I'm saying?
Well, it's a little bit too late. I think prevention is first thing. but now, pay rates, I suppose, that's the biggest interest for people to actually get the work done. So if pay rates would be increased, they would just go and grab the job and do it. Yeah, but prevention is the first thing, I suppose. Yeah.
It's quite a difficult question, but maybe if the government just helps more vulnerable people so they don't have to worry, and making sure they don't, like, crazy buy loads of stuff, because unfair for the people who can't get as much things, can't afford travel.
I say the government ain't going to listen, yeah. You know, but the government should really sort of scrap Brexit, open up the import entries, but that's not going to happen. The government obviously wants this to happen to cause more hunger, to cause more stress, to cause less food on the street, to put more homeless in the street over it. That's what's going to happen in 2030, essentially, is they're going to cause a whole depopulation, massive
mass extermination event.
Yeah.
It sounds crazy, but that's the goal, I guess.
I mean, me personally, I have no clue if they could do it better. But one thing for sure, I think, is they concentrate a lot of things in London. You know, central London is the main thing, and maybe we should go somewhere else. Maybe there's the private areas that have a lot of skilled people that, you know, should be, you know, spread, not be just London. This is my opinion.
You can start reinvesting in local industries, local farming. Start supporting and stop cutting the subsidies to the farmers. You need to replace the subsidies that the EU used to give us, and stop talking this nonsense about re-greening or rewilding the land while we have to buy from Spain, from France, from Thailand. We're buying fish from Thailand. I can't believe that. Tilapia, I don't know. We can't grow it here. We have salmon in Scotland. Why don't we subsidize Scotland so the price is competitive with tilapia so we can serve it in the schools? I don't get that one. But it is just the nature of the business, I guess. We don't want to be seen as subsidizing essential. We protect defense economy, which is our missiles, and you have to get licensed. But we don't seem to protect our food for some strange reason. We don't buy British. We prefer international food. It tastes better, I'm not lying to you, but it makes us vulnerable, and that's it.
Think twice before you make a judgment. And don't spend your money on silly things. There's a lot of, especially here in Harlesden, a lot of knife crime. So I've heard a lot of train stations have been built, but at the same time, there's a lot of people here that are poor, a lot of people that don't have homes, a lot of homeless people around here, a lot of knife crime, a lot of drugs, a lot of drug dealing. Yeah, this is what Harlesden is known for.
We asked the public how they feel about the prospect of ongoing out-of-stock products and the very real possibility that this could be the beginning of a long, cold winter of shortages for the entire country.
I don't want to think about it, to be honest. I'm just pushing that idea away. I had already headache with this petrol thing, you know, so I'm just pushing away that idea. I'm hoping by the end of this year everything will be sorted, or at least the shortage will be sorted, and, you know, everybody could at least have a nice Christmas and everything. But I'm not, to be honest, I'm not very hopeful, but that's what I'm hoping for.
Very worried. Very. I've got 4 kids, of course, so very worried that will make me. Yeah, it's food. It's not something that is unnecessary or extra. It's food. It's needed.
It will just bring us back to the same depression most of us went through last year in 2020. So I really do hope the government are spending all day trying to figure out a plan to counterattack this upcoming situation for the winter.
Yeah, I was probably trying to get some food supplies for myself. Yeah, frustrating, of course. Yeah, that would be frustrating. I think people might need a little bit of notice if that would happen, so they could survive the winter through. Yeah, there's other ways to get food, but yeah, if there's enough notice, then fair enough. If there's no notice, then very frustrating, of course. I would think of whether I should be actually staying there for a long time or not if these things are happening.
Yeah, actually, UK is a highly, highly rated country, apparently, and I think they should have looked at it. Yeah, I mean, I'm just trying to rephrase my words, and I think it's a bit weird, so I think it's about time to fix it then.
Yeah. Yes, of course, and I not a case of do, they know they can do something about it, but I think they just want to put the fear into people for whatever crazy reason they choose to do it.
If it ever got to that, then we would transition to our emergency supplies, and then we'll start rationing food, which is the emergency procedure in every country. But, and I think we have enough rations to stock up to feed us for a long time. So even if it got to that, we would have a plan to get through that. And I'm not really worried about that, to be honest with you. Another point I'd like to touch on, the petrol shortage. There was no petrol shortage. I don't know why people were panic buying petrol. Do you see any more shortages? 1 week after, no shortage. There wasn't a shortage in the first place. I think it's just a mixture of misinformation on social media, as usual, the usual tool. Because I say, oh, we have a shortage, let's go and get it. But in essence, I don't think we have a shortage. And I think the government isn't that stupid, to be honest with you. I think some of them are really smart people, some of them are clowns. And the really smart people tend to be planners. And if it ever got to that, we'd have to dip in our emergency situation supplies. And that's it.
Well, everyone will feel upset. Everyone will feel kind of hurt. But it's at the end of the day, it's the politicians. It's the politicians that make the choices. And like I said, we suffer, we pay. If they make a good choice, then it's good for us. If they don't, then obviously we suffer.
I would be unhappy because how are we going to get our food? And it's winter. Nobody wants to step outside. Like, we would want to, like, stock up on food and, like, keep it at our houses instead of coming out and constantly in the cold as well. And, like, it's not. Some people have children, so it's not a good time, basically. Yeah.
Well, during coronavirus, it was quite similar. There was hardly anything. It was quite difficult for, like, my family because I have to do the shopping, so... it's quite difficult for a lot of people having to worry about things that we shouldn't have to worry about.
Britain stands outside the European Union with supply problems, delivery issues, and self-generated panic buying by the public. So far, and despite assurances from government ministers that they are working to solve the issue, the public remains nervous and unsure that these shortages will be resolved in the months ahead.
This could be the legacy of decisions made by the country and by politicians who seem unprepared and unable to restock empty shelves, plus a haulage sector with 100,000 unfilled vacancies. And all the while, the UK, outside Europe and in the midst of a supply chain crisis, faces these problems alone as it heads towards what could turn out to be a winter of discontent, out of solutions and out of stock.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The row over the British government's handling of COP26 planning has emerged amid public order concerns, with up to 150,000 protesters expected to take to Glasgow's streets in early November, alongside the crucial climate talks. which will require one of the largest policing operations ever undertaken in Britain. We now present you an article written by Gillian Ambrose. The piece is titled COP26 Corporate Sponsors Condemn Climate Summit as Mismanaged. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Companies that have stumped up millions of pounds to sponsor the COP26 climate summit have condemned it as mismanaged and very last minute in a volley of complaints as next month's event in Glasgow draws near. The sponsors, which include some of Britain's biggest companies, have raised formal complaints blaming very inexperienced civil servants for delayed decisions, poor communications and a breakdown in relations between the organisers of the event and firms in the run-up to the landmark talks. The Guardian understands that a letter to the organisers, written by broadcaster Sky and co-signed by senior leaders from other COP26 sponsors, has raised concerns with them over these and other problems, and followed another co-signed letter in July. Britain is running its COP26 presidency from within the Cabinet Office, under the leadership of the former Business Secretary Alok Sharma, who is the COP26 president, and the businessman Nigel Topping, who was appointed the government's so-called high-level climate action champion last year. Sponsorship is expected to help defray a policing bill estimated to reach up to £250 million. Alongside Sky, the summit has 10 other major sponsors, including energy giants Hitachi, National Grid, Scottish Power, and SSE. US technology titan Microsoft, and the FTSE companies GSK, National Westminster Bank, Reckitt, Sainsbury's and Unilever. Unilever has denied signing the letter penned by Sky. Other lower tier partners include the carmaker Jaguar Land Rover and the furniture retailer IKEA. One source employed by the COP26 sponsor said that the biggest frustration was the lack of information about how the event will run and the role for its key backers, because important questions have gone unanswered and planning decisions have been delayed. The source said they had an extra year to prepare for COP26 due to COVID, but it doesn't feel like this time was used to make better progress. Everything feels very last minute. Upcoming climate talks in Glasgow, considered by many as the last chance to put the world on track to meet its climate ambitions, are due to take place in early November, after the event was postponed by a year because of the outbreak of COVID-19 in early 2020. They have already been thrown into turmoil by suggestions that the Chinese President Xi Jinping will skip the event, threatening the chances of a global pact with one of the world's biggest industrial nations. Organisers of COP26 promised sponsors an outstanding opportunity and unique benefits in exchange for their support, including a chance to promote their brands at the conference Green Zone exhibition space and the participation of government ministers at their event,